network and visit. Oh, there he is. And visit with people. I haven't seen Kevin Smithers since we lived in the same dormitory. I guess I moved out in the December of 1980. I don't think I've seen you since then, Kevin. I'm surprised you recognize me at all. About twice the size as I was about 75 pounds ago, Kevin Smithers and I were friends. And as we were talking, I was remembering a favorite moment in our relationship that also connects with relationship with my wife. I was actually on the phone with Beth, my wife, back in the days when we were dating, and in the days when in the dormitory there was only one phone per hall. Yeah, that was a long time ago. Well, I was on the phone with Beth, and Kevin Smithers, Kevin just loved picking on people who were half his size, which I was at the time. Kevin, for no apparent reason, without provocation, came along, picked me up by the ankles, and was bouncing me on the head. I don't know if it was actually making contact, my head and the ground, but he was bouncing me around while I'm on the phone with this woman who thinks I'm her protector. It has caused some deep scars in me ever since, so Kevin and I will discuss this after presentation today. What? That's true. And I won't say anything about that. Well, I appreciate your serious interest in missions. This is one of those sessions that puts the work in workshop. Because we're talking about some big questions that face us as we face this, what Aldous Huxley would describe as a brave new world. He wasn't interested in missions, like we all are. But it is the world that he said it would be. And consequently, there are many issues that we wrestle with in missions that are just different than they once were. I have a brother who's 5 years older than I am. When he was in high school, 5 years ahead of me, he was in the high school band and had to endure a changing of the guard. The old band director left, new band director came. I think you have to have been in the high school band somewhere to understand what trauma that could cause you. It was actually a move in the right direction because the former band director was not very good and watched the ranks of our high school band dwindle down to maybe 50 band members. And yet he was still very old school, still insisted at halftime shows on spelling the name of our town, Noonan, on the field. It's hard to spell Noonan with 50 band members. It's almost impossible to get two sousaphone players to form an A. Or even to play an A, at least in my high school. Try to spell Noonan out there with just too few people. So unless you were good at reading Morse code or Braille, you couldn't tell that that actually said Noonan. Well, the next guy came in and said, that's ridiculous. You don't have enough band members to spell Noonan on the field. So here's what we're going to do. Here's what he did. He said, if you play a woodwind, in marching season, you now play either a drum or a brass instrument. We'll teach you three or four notes. Doesn't matter if you know how to play them all. But we can't hear that clarinet or that flute up there in the stands, not if our band is only 50 members. So he converted all the woodwinds to brass players or percussionists. And then he said, forget these fancy designs on the field. And he had them all lined up on the goal line, one end of the field. And with their brass instruments at the ready, they marched down the field in a perfectly straight line. Couldn't do much else. But they mastered that one perfectly straight line. Then they pinwheeled that thing and faced the home stands and just blasted Delta Dawn, what's that flower you have on? And I mean, I was in 7th or 8th grade. It was a spiritual experience. I've been in missions committee meetings where I thought, man, we need that band director to come to this committee and convince us that we're not really doing that much if we send $50 here and $100 there. Now, we feel good about it because we have our hands in so many different pots, but as far as really making any noise, we would do better if we consolidated, if we focused, if we did one thing really well. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about, which brings me to question number 6 of the 10 big questions. But I'm going to start back on question 1 for the benefit of those who say I talk too fast. or who didn't get that website address this morning, where you can find this entire outline in case you're interested in such a nuts and bolts kinds of discussion. The website again is www. Someone told me in the break between that I talked too fast even when I gave the web address, so now I'm very sensitive. It was www.harding.edu/CWM, which stands for Center for World Missions. Again, not the Center for World Missions, but a Center for World Missions. Harding.edu/CWM, and there you'll find a more complete outline of this presentation than the one I'm looking at here. And there you'll also find these first of the 5 or the 10 big questions I raised, the first 5 of which I raised this morning. Question 1 was, how will we respond to the pluralism and the relativism of our culture? Question 2, will we send our sons and daughters to an increasingly dangerous world, especially the major blocks of unreached peoples of the world? We're talking Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, Shintoists, and others who may be particularly hostile to this exclusive Christian gospel as we proclaim it. Question 3, how will we respond as more and more nations close their doors to Western missionaries? And as our access to those places is restricted, and will be more so, I believe, in the wake of events in Iraq and world opinion against America because of it. Question 4, how will we respond to the urbanization of our world, since most of our churches are suburban or rural, not urban? Yes, we have some inner city churches, but we don't have hardly any strong urban churches. If you're part of one, I'd sure like to hear about it. And then question 5, will we commit to cross-cultural missions, cross-cultural ministry in our own communities? God's bringing the world to us. There's an opportunity there that we overlook. If all we do is get on airplanes and travel thousands of miles from home and never intentionally build those bridges into the communities of people all around us that just aren't like us. But then question 6, with that marching band in mind, this is my question. Will we do what it takes to be more intentional about the way we do missions? It's not a heavy emotional question. But do you think your church, your missions committee, your eldership, whoever leads the missions program, the missions ministry at your church, are we willing to do what it takes to make that ministry more intentional? Doing what it takes would include, among other things, 1, establishing some sort of criteria by which we make missions decisions and doing that in advance. Don't you know what that feels like to come together as a missions committee? And we have all these letters from all these people asking us for money, and essentially we have, you know, only X number of dollars to spend, so it kind of becomes a first-come, first-served thing. And we piecemeal out our relatively small budget and accomplish very little. Well, it makes more sense to me to establish in advance some criteria on the basis of which we'll make some missions decisions. 2, doing what it takes to be more intentional means you're going to have to do a better job at home in your own church of some missions education. Some of you are still reading some very old missions books. But surprise, surprise, the world has changed dramatically in the last 25 years or so. You need to update your missions library. Wouldn't be a bad idea to purchase a book like this one. I'm assuming there's a PowerPoint display behind me. Can I point to it? Is there a book up there by Stan Guthrie called Missions in the Third Millennium? The subtitle of that book is 21 Key Trends in Missions. I promise you, it's not the greatest book you'll ever read. It's not even the best missions book that's out there. I see one of my students from a class where we're using it who's laughing because I always make fun of the book for not actually having 21 trends. I think I could have named those trends in about 8. But he stretches them out to 21. At any rate, the good thing about that book is, here's a very recent book that will update you about some current issues in missions thinking across the board, not just in the Fellowship of Churches of Christ. So I'd encourage you to read something like that and encourage other members of your missions committee to read that too, or even make it a requirement if you feel bold enough to have requirements of your members of your missions committee back home. And if that seems too boring, or if inviting some missions expert to your church to do one more seminar on one more weekend that you really don't want to sacrifice for the missions program, well, forget that and come to Hutt. HUT stands for Harding University Dakota. Now, yes, this is a shameless promotion of a brand new thing, but something that's not duplicated elsewhere. So I feel good about saying to an audience like this of people serious about missions, hey, bring your group to HUT for a weekend, 24 hours, 48 hours, and we will guide you through 24 or 48 hours worth of simulations in the Global Village, where you'll actually live in one of six different dwellings. We'll give you currency. Well, I said we'll give it to you. You'll actually work for it. You'll make mud bricks. You'll slaughter animals. A wonderful time will be had by all. You'll be paid in currency. And I'll warn you in advance, if you're a woman, you won't make as much, because it is a real-world experience. And then, in between moments of simulation, then we sit down under a tree out in the open and we talk about missions. It's a whole lot more fun than attending all those seminars that I myself have presented in churches around the country where it's just a little bit hard to get excited about it. So come to HUT. Don't need to say more about that, because if you'd like to know more about that, there is a promotional video, you guessed it, at www.harding.edu/CWM. You can click on the picture and there's a video that will play and tell you what else you need to know. If you just can't wait to get home and get on the internet to find that, then you might want to go by the Harding University table and ask for a HUT, little HUT brochure for Harding University Dakota, this Global Village program. You bring all that to bear then in the third way about getting serious about being intentional, and that would be just to write a missions policy. Now, you can contact Ed Matthews at ACU, who does an entire weekend seminar guiding you through the process of writing a missions policy statement if you want to. You could also contact Monty Cox, who wouldn't spend the whole weekend doing that, but we could talk about that, and I'll refer you to some materials from Ed Matthews. Doesn't sound like an exciting thing to do, but if you don't, then you are destined to have the same conversations over and over again in your church missions committee. Spell out some criteria in advance and put them in the form of a missions policy statement, which has at the heart of it some sort of missions statement. Now, if it were me doing the seminar, this is the one I would propose. A statement that would guide those missions decisions, but a statement that would also reflect what's needed in the world. All too often, we make decisions in missions based on what we want to do, rather than on what the real need out there in the world is. Here's what the world needs now, in the humble opinion of one guy. We need churches to send out teams to plant clusters of indigenous churches among receptive people groups and cities of the world, churches that will then have enough resources to evangelize to the fringes of their people group or city and beyond. You see, that doesn't sound too exciting to talk about that all weekend long. So come to HUT. We'll do some interactive stuff, and then I'll tell you about this, and I'll explain what the highlighted, the blue words are all about. It's a loaded statement which ought to raise all kinds of questions in your minds, like, why teams? What do you mean by clusters of indigenous churches? And why are you focusing on receptive peoples? And why this and why that? Well, it's because otherwise we are a marching band of 50 trying to spell Jesus on the field. I believe we need to focus. That's question 6. Will we do what it takes to be more intentional? Question 7. Will we commit to long-term personal evangelism here and abroad, as opposed to short-term, less personal evangelism? It feels funny for me to talk about personal evangelism. In the old days when I was growing up, we used to have personal work classes. But you and I both know you don't call it personal work anymore. It's kind of ironic, because over time, what we used to call personal work has become increasingly less personal. Become more and more dependent on some sort of gimmick, some sort of piece of paper, which isn't in and of itself an evil thing, but which reinforces the notion that evangelism is what happens when you sit down and you shut up and I open my mouth and I tell you what you're supposed to believe. And that passes for evangelism. I mean, the Lord himself had conversations with people. Well, that sounds more appropriate to me, a dialogical kind of evangelism. And among other things, it's a whole lot more personal. God's method of evangelism, I think, is pretty clear. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I'm sorry, there are no shortcuts for that. If we're going to get the Word out, and you know I don't mean the contents of a book. I'm talking about the Word with a capital W. The Word who became flesh and dwelt among us and dwells among us still. If we're going to flesh out that Word in the world, it's going to take more than some mass media gimmick, which may contribute in some auxiliary way. But the prime mode of operation has got to be the Word becoming flesh, living and dwelling among people, here or there. There was a movement in my town when I was gone to Chicago. The way I say that, it makes it sound as if it wouldn't have happened had I been home. I'm sure it would have still. But it was an attempt by local churches in Searcy to shut down a bookstore that our members felt was selling some smutty materials, and suppose they were. They circulated petitions, collected names, dropped those names off at the door, and eventually that bookstore did, in fact, close its doors and leave town. Now, I realize this is not a missions example of something impersonal, but it's kind of related to mission, how we flesh out our faith in the world. Had I been there, I don't think I could have felt good about participating in that. The reason is, that's the spiritual equivalent of an airstrike, isn't it? Where you shoot mortars at them, you lob grenades from a distance, you get in your jet, you fly over, you drop the bomb, you go home. It was less risky, a lot safer, and wholly ineffective, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to fleshing out in front of people what it looks like to follow Jesus in the world. And don't you know that while we're collecting petitions or picketing outside the doors, Jesus himself would more likely be inside, having a cup of coffee with the manager, developing a relationship with a woman, a relationship that just might inspire her to one day herself take the smutty books off the bookshelves. You think? The Word must become flesh and dwell among people. Something happened to us at some point where we got it in our heads that spiritual commitment is best seen in your willingness to step back away from the world and say, please don't cuss in front of me. And that's as spiritual as you get. Well, for the Word to become flesh, you're going to have to dwell among some people. If you fall back on less personal means of getting that Word out, I think you're falling back on something that's less than what Jesus himself would do. Will we commit to the more difficult, much more costly, personal kind of evangelism? And what do you mean, short-term or long-term? We made a list a few years ago at Harding of top 10 positive trends in missions in churches of Christ. Then we made another list of top 10 negative trends in churches of Christ. Two lists, two top 10 lists. If you make lists these days, there have to be 10 things on them. Thank you, David Letterman. Short-term missions was on both lists. It's a positive thing. Have any of you been part of a church that sent large numbers of their own members to the mission field? Any of you? You know, when those people come back, they are energized, invigorated for missions like nothing else could possibly hope to do. For them to have personal experience there on the field, even if it's only for a week or two, will affect them long term like nothing else can. So I'm a fan of short term missions. On the other hand, it is also possible that those same people come back and think, yeah, missions, I've done missions. You go, you knock on doors, you pass out leaflets, you invite people to the gospel meeting, and it's in Spanish, and you can't really understand. Yeah, I've done missions. And it is possible that sometimes short-term missions obscure the more effective long-term missions, where it's much more likely that somebody is living and dwelling among the people. Now, in my opinion, the most effective short-term mission efforts are connected to ongoing long-term mission works. So where your church goes and works hand in hand with an incarnational missionary, somebody on the field who is fleshing out their faith in front of others, who knows the local culture, speaks the local language, that's when that short-term mission effort has a better chance of being effective. But I plead with you. God's people have to recommit to doing it the hard way, to becoming the Word made flesh, living and dwelling among people. God is not looking for people who are willing to do more airstrikes. He's trying to raise up some ground troops who will do this the way He did it, when He had the most important message to deliver that's ever been delivered to anyone. He did what you do in that case. He delivered that message in person. And so must you. Question 8. Now, this is really nuts and bolts here. So if you were planning to take a nap at some point in this presentation, this would be the time. It's real important enough for me to go ahead and tell you this. But you, if you're interested, you want to access this on the website. Question 8, how can we partner with nationals in ways that help and don't hurt? We used to call nationals natives. We used that word so much that we even ourselves had pictures of natives running around in loincloths, bones through their nose, which of course would be our natives these days, with the bones through their nose. So we call them nationals these days. How can we partner with nationals in other parts of the world in ways that help and don't hurt? Partnership is a buzzword, has been for about 20 years in missions now. Not a bad one, especially because it's replacing an older way to think about how Americans or Europeans did missions with mission field churches in Africa or Asia or Latin America or even in Europe, in which there was this paternalistic relationship. We are the mother church. We're sending our young missionaries. We send them to plant these little infant baby churches, and then we spend the rest of their lives petting those little baby churches. Little baby church can't do anything on its own. It was condescending. It was arrogant. It was sinful. Shame on us. Well, thank God it's being replaced with a better way to think about it. Those Africans, those Asians, those Europeans are your brothers. They may not have been in Christ as long as some of you have. Some of them have been in Christ longer than you have. But regardless of how long they've been in Christ, you treat them as equals. They are your partners in the gospel. They are not your underlings. About 6 years ago, for the first time, some of my elders, that is elders who had supported our work in Kenya and that of my teammates, they came to visit us. And one of them was my dad. Another was my father-in-law. I mean, two of them had been to visit, but not in their capacity as elders in the days we lived in Kenya. Finally, I was able to twist enough arms and persuade some of these elders to come and visit. We were actually going to attend a meeting of African elders in the Kalenjin-speaking part of Kenya where I was. Churches that we had planted that now had ordained elders that were inviting American elders to come to that meeting and inviting those American elders to come teach the Africans. Oh, these American elders are good, godly men. They're my two dads and other fine men, but I know that on that plane, as we talk together about what we might say, what they might say, elder to elder, I know that in their minds, they were thinking, yeah, we're going to go teach these new elders a few things about being elders. Some of you have had enough experiences on the mission field that you know that the return trip was different. That on that airplane on the way home, they were buzzing about how much they had learned. They felt ashamed when they compared their own commitments as elders to the commitments that they saw demonstrated in the lives, ministries of those godly African elders. There is much that my African elder friends can learn from my American elders, and there is much that those African elders could teach my American elders. Don't you think? I am an elder now. I would love to take our entire eldership to an African elders meeting and just shut up and listen. I would love to just listen in on their concerns. I would have to translate, but I would love to just let them listen in on the things that concern them the most. Some of them immature things and some of them important mature things. I think it would be so valuable. But for the two groups to interact as equals. Some of you participate in something called Jabalani, Africa, 2002. It was in August at Richland Hills a couple of years ago. One of my favorite moments at that event, which brought African leaders and American church leaders together as partners. Not Americans over the Africans, but bring us together as partners. There were several panels, and on every panel throughout the program, there would be one African who'd been in Christ a long time, maybe an elder, maybe an evangelist, and one American missionary. Generally speaking, there would be two guys from Ethiopia, American, Ethiopian. Two guys from Uganda, American, Uganda. And I thought, you know, if people in this audience who have no experience in Africa don't even hear a thing they're saying, if they could just go home with that picture in their mind of that African sitting by that American, side by side, sharing together the task of taking this gospel to the continent of Africa. Wonderful, beautiful scene. When I picture my own ministry in Africa, one of the first images that comes to mind is from my favorite little church. Please don't tell them that I told you they're my favorite little church. I doubt that you'll meet them until we get to heaven. I'd rather you not even tell them then. They're right on the equator. They go by the name that sounds odd to you but sweet to me. The name is Olbat. About six guys at Olbat, most of them twice my age, in their 70s and 80s now. They were in their 50s and 60s when we first met. They're just one of the 128 congregations that now dot the Kalenjin countryside. I just was with them again this past August, and we sat under the same acacia tree we used to sit under. We drank tea. We laughed. We laughed at Kandiye and his dumb jokes. Laughed at Jeff Katon, whose ears just get longer and longer as he gets older. He poked holes in his earlobes like most of these guys did. Stretched them down, but his just get stretched out more and more. One of the guys in the circle broke one of his earlobes, climbing through a barbed wire fence, and we had a good laugh about that. Hadn't seen that since I'd last seen him. When I think of Christian fellowship, I quickly picture myself sitting in that circle with those men. Now, if you were to ask them, they would say, that Arab song, which is my African name. They would say, that Arab song, that boy, they call me boy. That boy, we love that boy. But I would say to you, I have learned so much from those men I introduced to Christ. Wonderful partnership. Those are my partners in the gospel. It's a wonderful thing. Well, then money enters the picture. Something happens when money enters the picture that changes the dynamics of such a partnership. So if you don't mind, let me talk about that for a minute. The dynamics of partnership where money is involved. Here is a question I would use to frame this part of the discussion. How do we balance the need to share our wealth with our brothers with the crippling effects of dependency? You feel that question? Those of you with some missions experience, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Here we are, wealthy, beyond the imagination of many in the world. How do we balance our obligation to share as good stewards out of our abundance with all that we've been told over the years, crippling effects of creating a financial dependency of churches on the mission field on churches abroad? Effects like these from a fellow by the name of Glenn Schwartz. You want to read from Glenn Schwartz? Check the website, get the information. He says, number one, the local agenda is set by outsiders. You know, I believe you, brethren, you need to hire a support man here. Or you need to hire an event. You need a Bible school. That's what you need. You need a Bible school. And the locals will say, well, okay. All right. If you provide the money, I guess we'll do a Bible school. You got the money, therefore you get to set the agenda. Probably not an agenda they themselves would have set. But because you're the one providing the funds, they're happy to go along. B, progress locally is dependent on outside funds in such an arrangement. You've planted that church. You think to yourself, they've got to have a church building. How can you have church without church building? So you help build them a building. You can't have church without a paid preacher, so you provide the funds to pay the preacher. Well, he can't really be a paid preacher until he goes to Bible school, and they can't afford to send him to Bible school. So we pay the scholarship that sends him to school, and then pay the salary that enables him to preach there. Then they say, by the way, we'd like to start another church in that village. Would you help us with another building and another preacher? And that's another scholarship. You see, progress then is impeded because of the method you've chosen, which is too dependent on affluence that they don't have. C, foreign salaried preachers are not free to innovate. Let me be clear, I don't want them to innovate that much. If they start saying Jesus didn't come in the flesh, that's not called an innovation. That's called heresy. On the other hand, if those preachers are paid by you, the missionary, or by you, the foreign church, then they are beholden to you, I think, in unhealthy ways. D, self-image and community image is diminished. Don't you think the others in that neighborhood know where that money comes from? To you, $100 a month is not that much. This is bargain-based missionary, and he knows the language and culture. I wonder how others in that community feel about this man who they know is making probably twice as much as they make, and all he has to do is preach on Sunday. And then E, what may have been intended as short-term assistance becomes long-term addiction to foreign funds. You optimistically say 5 years from now we'll start pulling back and then they'll have it on their own. Unwittingly, you're operating on an economic model that used to be true in America, that you could count on future prosperity, growth of this church, and also future prosperity in that locale will enable them to take up the slack that will be left when we start gradually pulling out. You can't assume that even about America anymore. Well, you and I could sit and argue about this a long time. Could I at least urge you to be cautious about freely sending too much American money overseas? You mean well, but you may cripple that church more than you help it. So how do you help it? Financially, without hurting it? Well, thank you for asking. I have 4 suggestions. Number 1, first of all, funds should only be given, in my opinion, for projects that can be maintained locally. If you abandon the mansion you live in and hand it to me, I still couldn't live in it. You know why? I can't afford to pay the light bill. Chances are, if I didn't have the income to construct the mansion in the first place, I won't have the income to maintain the mansion even if you give it to me. Make sense? Here's a good rule of thumb then. If you're being asked to send money to a project, one-time money, that then will require monthly money to be maintained, whether that project is paying a preacher, buying a motorcycle, buying them a vehicle, if they couldn't buy it, they probably can't maintain it. It would be better to help them, to support them in the projects that they can maintain on their own. Number 2, aid given by foreign partners should be tied to what locals have already given. Not to use a condescending kind of illustration, but I'm thinking with my Sarah, youngest daughter, now 16, at the age of 6 or so, said she wanted a trampoline. Now, Beth and I are thinking of horror stories from emergency rooms around America. No, we don't want her to have a trampoline. But we thought better that we just say, Sarah, if you can save up half the money on your $1 per week allowance for the next 6 years, then we will kick in the other half. And then Sarah starts doing it. Dollar a week. Man, she wouldn't buy anything. Dollar a week. She's sucking that money away for 3 years until eventually, thankfully, she lost interest in the trampoline. You know, we're trying to teach her something about sacrifice, how much things cost. She was willing to sacrifice for something she really wanted. People everywhere are. I was chastised by some of those same loved ones at Olbon. Those same men I love, I know they love me too, but they chastised me in 1998 when I went back and said, well, what do you need? I've been gone 6 years. Where do you feel like you're the weakest? And they looked at me and they said, Arap-san, you failed us in that you did not teach us how to give. And I thought, you know, the reason I didn't teach you how to give is because I'm driving a Toyota Hilux that costs $25,000 in cash I'm putting $2.50 worth of gas. Well, not $2.50, that's $2.50 per gallon. Unbelievable prices, huh? Those African gas prices. Putting $2.50 a gallon worth of gas to come here. I mean, I'm spending all this money just to visit you, and I know how dirt poor you are. It's hard for me to look at you and tell you you need to give more out of your poverty. And they looked at me and said, still, you did us wrong. You should have taught us how to give. They're right, aren't they? And when we help people do what they could do, at least in some way, to some extent on their own resources, we are robbing them of the incentive to do it, depriving them of the sense of ownership that will bless them later on. See, this is too long, but financial partners should be open about the nature of the local accountability structure, trust that structure, give funds to specific projects without excessive earmarking. That means if you send that money overseas for some request that's been made of you, and then you find out later that they had a drought, they spent that on corn instead of on the roof of their building. Well, don't get all huffy about that. Do you know what it's like to be poor? Where sometimes the urgent takes precedent over the long term. Don't get too huffy about that. And then finally, D, the financial partnership is best served if the missionary is not the middleman receiving and dispersing the funds. We have put way too many missionaries in a dangerous situation. We have set them up for all kinds of accusations later on. Thinking of one particular situation, also from Africa, where a missionary pulled out, a missionary who was paying about 10 guys who were under him. Make no mistake about it, that's even how he talked about it. These are evangelists that are under me. Oh, well, what are you? Well, I'm just a missionary. That's what it looked like. That guy leaves, the locals got together, devised a mechanism whereby that money could still flow from the States, appointed one of their own as the replacement, and called him the bishop. Church back in Texas said, well, we don't do bishops. Can you imagine how confused those Africans were? Well, who was that missionary? Well, he was not a bishop. He was a missionary just like you. And they're going, he wasn't like us. For some reason, when you replace that missionary with an African who now receives the funds and disperses them, it looks like a hierarchy. You may be building a hierarchy you'll want to dismantle later on if you're using a missionary as a middleman for the funds. Okay, that's some real nuts and bolts stuff. But in a nutshell, what we're after here is a sense of ownership. Do you know why welfare failed in America for so long? Do you know why the housing and urban development folks are rethinking how they do what they do in America? Do you know why there's so many boarded up housing projects on the south side of Chicago where I used to live? It's because there was no ownership. Where there is no ownership, there will not be any growth. You're not helping people overseas when you send them money in a way that hurts rather than enhances their sense of ownership. Okay, something more interesting. Question 9. Will we commit to holistic ministry that transforms without watering down the message? Probably most of you are not too troubled by that word holism, but some are, because some are old enough to remember the old days of the social gospel, where really in truly liberal circles, people had decided that it's not appropriate for us to try to persuade them that Jesus is the unique Son of God, but it's still okay for us to pass out cups of cold water in His name. That then passed for holistic ministry. Doing dental work, doing medical work, doing agricultural ministry, building schools, helping people in these, what we used to call secular things, and just not telling them much about Jesus. Well, that's what I have in mind, kind of, when I call this holistic ministry that transforms, but without watering down the message. It's not bait either. Some of us think that benevolence is only legitimate if it leads to evangelism. Benevolence opens the door. Benevolence is legitimate in its own right. Isn't it? I hope every conversation I have somehow leads to another conversation with that same person about their eternal destiny. I hope everything leads to evangelism, including benevolence. But we don't use benevolence as bait. That's not what legitimizes these other kinds of ministry. We also wrestle as Americans with this false dualism between spiritual and physical. Well, we've got the Medical Missions Conference every January, and those folks are worried about the physical well-being. And then we got the other missionary gatherings where those people worry about the spiritual well-being. No. That's America talking. That's not Scripture talking. Maybe a better word than holism is just the word reconciliation. I think I can stick a lot of stuff under the heading reconciliation, don't you? This ministry that's all through the Bible, start to finish, making right what sin in the world has broken. Genesis 1 and 2, God makes the world exactly like it should have been. Makes it perfectly. Chapter 3, we show up. Mess everything up. The rest of the story is God taking the initiative first through Israel, then through the agency of the church, to make right what we in the world have done wrong. The whole Bible, I believe, is the story of reconciliation, including my favorite part of the Bible, when Jesus, the Word, is made flesh and comes and dwells among us. And He walks up to a leper. Have you ever seen a leper? That's horrible. It's a leper that used to sit on the steps of our grocery store in Eldoret, Kenya. Facial features already eaten away. No fingers, no toes anymore, because Hansen's disease, as it's called now, has eaten his extremities. He's on the skin, asleep at night. His hand flops over in the fire, but he can't feel it till it burns down to the healthy part of his hand, but then it's too late. It's awful. Jesus, the Son of God, appears, and there's a leper. Jesus, who was there when that man was made, who knows how people are supposed to look, He can take one look at that man and say, no, no, that's not the way it's supposed to be. And because He's the Creator, He's also the recreator. He can reach out His hand and He can touch that man and make him like he was supposed to have been all along. He has conversation with a Samaritan woman. Nobody else is going to talk to that woman, at least not in public, because she's a Samaritan woman. But at least when Jesus is there, somebody's going to do this right. Somebody's going to make right what the world gets wrong. Even that's reconciliation, isn't it? And the more this recreator consumes more of my life and more of my agenda, the more He reaches through me to remake whatever broken thing I find around me. Whether it's feeding homeless people or sheltering them or taking care of people in our town who don't have insurance and doing all of it unapologetically in Jesus' name, taking advantage of every chance we have to have a conversation with anybody who will listen to us talk about the reason for the hope that we have. But we don't do that as bait. We do that because we are agents of reconciliation. Could we recommit to that whole ministry? And then last, this one's a little scary, but it's real significant. On the other side of the reorientation occurring among us at the moment in churches of Christ, will we unite to be a light to the Gentiles? Looking down at my notes, that word unite was spelled untie. I was glad that the fellow helping me with this caught that mistake early. Very different to be united as opposed to being untied for the sake of the Gentiles. You may call it an identity crisis. That sounds too negative to me, but maybe it's worthy of such a negative label. I prefer to think of it more positively as a reorientation taking place among us. Many of us grew up in churches that had their eyes firmly focused on the peripheral. Now we find ourselves in churches where people are learning to focus on the central issues of the Christian faith, namely, Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of God. If that's not true, I don't care where you go to church. I don't care what you believe about the frequency of the Lord's Supper. Who cares about baptism if that is not true? But that reorientation can be very disorienting if you've been focused on the boundaries for a long time. One of my professors in Chicago talks about bounded sets and centered sets. Imagine you're in a bounded set where people have their backs to the center. They're focused on this wall, spending most of their time trying to maintenance that wall to make sure nobody tears that wall down, the boundary that makes us, us. Anybody inside the wall is us. Anybody not inside the wall is not us. That's why we have to be real clear about where that wall is. It's a bounded set. We get our identity from the boundary. The other kind of set he calls a centered set. Picture people with their backs to the boundary facing the center, which is the cross. When they look over here and they see somebody else who may actually be on the outside of that old boundary, and they see that they too are focused on the center, they look at them differently than they once did. Not just as a total outsider, but somebody who, like me, is just as concerned as I am about trying to focus on being a disciple of Jesus. It's a different orientation. I don't like either one. I mean, that second one sounded sweet. I'm kind of drawn to that. But in fact, I think Scripture points me to an orientation that's some of both. Kind of a centered set with some boundaries, don't you think? Where primarily we're focused on the center, but a focus that doesn't eliminate all boundaries. When I hear the Apostle Paul writing, it sounds to me like you can be out and you can be in. I want to be in Christ where there is grace and forgiveness. I'm not in because I do all the right stuff. I'm in because I'm in Him who does all the right stuff and makes me right. You can be in and you can be out. But now we are in a culture that would rather eliminate all boundaries, honor none. My conviction is, I'm determined, from now on, I will only honor boundaries that God has clearly drawn Himself. You say, well, that makes you really liberal. No, it doesn't. I'm more conservative than you are. I know that's irritating to hear me say that. I am too conservative to draw lines that God has not clearly drawn. Just too conservative to do that. You may feel comfortable doing that, but I'm going to stop doing that. I'm too conservative. If God has not drawn those lines clearly in the sand, I'm not going to enforce them as if they are God's own boundaries, because I'm overstepping my responsibility as a messenger and taking on the role of a judge. Well, regardless of how you feel about that, we have got to talk about this more openly than we are at the moment. We have got to talk about this. I think we're afraid to, because we're afraid someone's going to label us conservative or liberal. Oh, you're like one of those people. I think we are a fellowship who has been bitten one too many times by some of those watchdogs who, thank God, are either not barking as loudly as they once did, or maybe we're just not paying attention anymore. I guarantee you, your children are not listening to them. They will not pay attention to them. And it's not entirely because they're so postmodern that they don't care at all about truth. That's not the entire story. Part of it is they have been more and more drawn to Jesus. And they spot in the spirit of those watchdogs who are so intent only on enforcing the boundaries, not drawing people to the center, which is Christ. They spot in that something antithetical to the spirit of Jesus a mile away. And they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. People of my generation and yours, if we insist on perpetuating a sectarian identity, we will lose our young people. And the flow of our youth into community churches will continue. We're going to have to talk about this more. And so, at the end, I ask once again, on the other side of this whole process in which our whole fellowship is being reoriented to the center in churches of Christ, can we, will we unite to be a light to the Gentiles? I'm thinking of the language of Isaiah 49, verse 6. Didn't realize what time it was, or I would elaborate on that more. It's the prophet Isaiah who becomes God's mouthpiece. It's through Isaiah that God says to the Israelites as they contemplate the return from exile, coming home to Palestine, it is too small a thing. Did you catch that? It is too small a thing to to restore the tribes of Israel, to bring back those of Jacob I've kept. I think I got that backwards, but it's the same thing. That's too small a dream. Just to bring back the faithful from exile and repatriate them to the land of Canaan. That's too small a thing. And I scratch my head and think, wait a second, Lord. That's been a very complicated thing. In fact, that one thing, getting them back from exile sometime around 538 B.C., and settling them in the land of Palestine so that they could find peace there with their Canaanite neighbors, that conflict still captures headlines in our newspapers now 2,500 years later. And God looks at them and says, that's too small a dream. Because he goes on to say, I made you to be a light to the Gentiles that you might bring my salvation to the ends of the earth. I'm not going to spend the rest of my time on restoration as an end in itself. Restoration never should have been, never has been in God's mind, an end in itself, but only a means to a greater end that we could unite with as many people as possible to be a light to the Gentiles. May God help us be just that. I have taken too much of your time. I apologize if you are late to the next event. Thank you for your attention.